This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Southern California, 70,000 grocery clerks are off the job. Picket lines are up outside Albertsons, Vons, which is owned by Safeway, and Ralph's, whose parent company is Kroger. The strike started last month, and this week the Teamsters decided to support the United Food and Commercial Workers Union by cutting off deliveries to some supermarkets in the days ahead of Thanksgiving. Like several high-profile labor conflicts in recent months, the dispute centers on health care. Benefits were also the big issue in negotiations at General Electric, Verizon, and at the big three automakers earlier this year. As health care costs continue to soar, some employers are trying to shift part of the financial burden onto their workers. Companies argue that after 5 years in a row of double-digit increases, they have no choice, while workers try to hold on to health care benefits that unions won many years ago. Later in this program, we'll talk about the surge of good economic news over the past few weeks. Today's jump in consumer confidence is just the latest uptick. But first, unions and health care. Is this a big issue where you work? Would you be willing to give up a pay increase to hold on to your health care? Whether you're management or labor, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we're going to begin with an update on the current labor standoff in Southern California. And joining us now is Nancy Cleland of the Los Angeles Times. She's with us on the phone from her office in Los Angeles, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Good to be here, Neil.
Any sign of a resolution between the grocery workers and their employers?
No, not at all. Both sides are very dug in at this point. It's going into its seventh week, and I was talking with some folks on a picket line yesterday, and they said this could go past Christmas.
What's the substance of the dispute?
Well, as you mentioned, health care is the central issue. The supermarkets have historically given a pretty generous health plan to their employees. Union workers currently have fully paid health benefits and vision and dental as well. They don't pay any premiums into that.
Mm-hmm.
And they've given up a lot of wage increases over the year and jurisdiction as well for that premier health plan. Now the markets are asking for pretty severe cuts in the level, not in the initial year of the contract they're seeking, but by the third year, the cuts would be pretty substantial. And even more infuriating to the union is that they're asking that all new hires come in under a very sparse health plan. They'd basically be paying about $2,200 a year for each employee, which doesn't buy much these days.
What do you think is going to be the effect of the entrance of the Teamsters into this conflict after several weeks, as you pointed out? Is this going to help break the impasse or deepen it?
Well, that's a good question. It's become somewhat personal between a couple of the key players on each side. So that always throws some unpredictability into the equation. But the Teamsters entering the fray is definitely going to be hurting the supermarkets and may force them to reexamine some of their stands.
Now, these supermarkets are all still open, right?
They're all still open. I was just out at a couple this morning just checking out their shelf situation, and one that I went to is completely out of frozen turkeys, but that may not be unusual 2 days before Thanksgiving anyway.
Any contingency plans that the grocery chains have developed to keep their stores open through what is usually, I guess, a pretty busy time of the year?
Sure. Well, some of the stores are actually going to be closed on Thanksgiving, which is highly unusual. They're hiring replacement drivers and warehouse workers, but this latest Teamsters move is taking 8,000 people out of the equation. They've got 8,000 Teamsters members at 9 distribution centers throughout the Southland, so it's going to be hard to replace all those folks.
No negotiations yesterday. When are they planning to return to the negotiating table?
There's no date been set for that. They negotiated over the weekend, and then after the union announced that they were going to be joined by the Teamsters, the talks broke off.
Nancy Cleland, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Nancy Cleland, a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. She was with us from her office in Los Angeles. As we've mentioned, healthcare costs are increasing for all employers and workers, not just those in labor unions. But to discuss the national trends in healthcare pricing and medical benefits, joining us now is Paul Ginsberg. He's president of the Center for Studying Health System Change. He's with us here in Studio 3A, and it's good of you to come in.
It's terrific to be here.
Give us a little context. How many Americans receive health insurance through employers?
Actually, according to the Census Bureau, about 175 million Americans receive insurance through an employer. And for the non-elderly population, that's about 65% of those. That's how they get their insurance.
And how does that compare to, say, 15 years ago?
It's actually about the same. There have been variations. In the early 1990s, we lost quite a number of people from employment-based coverage because of the recession then and the fact that premiums were escalating a lot. And the last 2 years, we're starting to lose people again.
How are costs now divided between the employer and the employee? And I assume that's been changing, too.
Yes. Well, actually, in the last few years, that's been relatively constant. And this surprises people, but that for someone who gets single coverage for the employee only, on average, the employee pays 16%. But for people who get family coverage, the employee pays about 27%. And these percentages have been constant over the last 3-4 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, we all know the healthcare costs are going up. How quickly, and can you encapsulate as to why?
Sure. Well, you know, health care premium increases have been in double digits for a few years now, and the latest data on 2003 shows about a 14% increase. But that probably understates the magnitude of what's going on because benefits are changing, and benefits are getting leaner. And after these benefit changes, it's still 14%. I estimate that if benefits had been the same, it would have been about 17% premium increase.
So, as we mentioned, this has been at the heart of, you know, you look at those increases and you can understand it, but it's been at the heart of negotiations with unionized shops. How are, in general, U.S. corporations dealing with this rising cost of health care?
That's right. Well, for the most part, they're looking to shift costs to their employees, although they have ideas about how to do it. I mentioned the percent paid by the employee was constant, and employers, for the most part, don't want to increase the employee contributions. They're concerned that fewer employees will take up, and instead they're changing the benefit structure of plans. They're increasing deductibles, increasing coinsurance and copayments, especially for prescription drug coverage. And they're envisioning that, this is probably better that people who use care pay more for it, and they're thinking about the incentives to economize on the use of care if patients are facing these costs at the point of service.
And how are unions, as a rule, responding to this new change environment?
Well, you know, unions have always had a different deal with health insurance. They've always put much higher emphasis on it than other workers. So there are many union plans that require no employee contributions. And, you know, employers are trying to increase those contributions, and unions in highly publicized cases are resisting it. I think there are also some cases that unions have gone along saying that what we know that additional costs employers bear for health care costs are going to mean less is available for money wages, and we'd like to have a balance. Mm-hmm. But in some of these highly publicized disputes, the unions have, in a sense, opted, saying, we'd rather you take it out of wage increases. We want excellent health insurance.
So, in essence, they're looking at it as, look, there's one pot of money that we can talk about for this contract, and you can devote, you know, X amount of it to health care or X amount of it to salary.
That's right.
Okay. Let's get some listeners involved. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org, and we'll start with Mark, who's in Denver, Colorado.
Hello, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a full-time union representative for the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers.
Mm-hmm.
I represent railroad machinists. We work on locomotives. We've been in contract negotiations for 4 years, And the sticking point, the major sticking point, has been health care benefits. And in the past, we've taken smaller raises and given up and allowed longer contract periods in order to take, to remain at a point where we don't have to pay. And right now, the railroads, the Class I railroads that we're in national contract negotiations with, want us to pay a portion of our health care benefits. And we still feel that even though there may be a bit of an economic downturn, the railroads still can afford to provide us with health care.
Do you feel that this would be giving back what a lot of people in your union have come to regard as a fundamental aspect of their employment?
Yes, we do. We feel it would be a big gift back.
On the other hand, as you look at the costs and the rise in health care costs from the company's point of view, do you understand a little bit of their position?
Yes, I do, but they're making enough profit to pay large dividends to shareholders, and they could pay smaller dividends and still continue to provide us with health care.
Any chance that your negotiations are going to be wrapping up anytime soon?
We had a session a couple of months ago. I'm not personally involved, but our negotiators had a session at the end of last month that didn't get anywhere, and we've asked to be released from arbitration, but at this point we're still talking.
Is this something that you think your members would strike over if necessary?
We had a strike vote in September, a ratification for their last best final offer, and the offer was turned down by 97%, and authorization to strike was agreed to by 96% of the members.
Paul Ginsberg, does that surprise you?
No, I think that many workers, first of all, aren't seeing this trade-off. They're saying this is just an issue of the employers can afford it and can afford it. It's mm-hmm. important to us, and we're going to insist on it. I think there are other union situations where perhaps often lower-paid workers, where there's really more sensitivity about this trade-off.
Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's try now to go to Eugene, who's with us from Albany, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, well, I'm calling because I'm a small business owner, really small. I'm the only employee, and I have to provide my own insurance, and I'm well aware of how much it costs. And I've always felt that there's been kind of a disconnect between union members and reality as far as what things cost. And like you said earlier, that they're required to pay virtually nothing, if nothing at all, for their health insurance. And, you know, it's costing the company $200 or $300 a month to provide their health insurance. And on top of that, they're already getting paid considerably more than people in the private sector. So I don't see why they feel that if the company's asking them to pay like a mere $20 or $30 to help supplement the cost of insurance, why it's such a big deal.
Paul Ginsberg, do you have an answer for him?
Well, I think it's a very well-taken position. Point I want to make is that a lot of this comes down to how rapidly healthcare costs are increasing. And in a sense, we have an increasing affordability problem, that we have cases where the employers are unable to continue to offer coverage. We have increasing instances of workers unable to enroll in the coverage because of what they need to pay. And unless there's some relief on the trend of health care costs, these issues are going to get more severe over time.
Eugene, obviously, this, as you say, you're the only employee in your business, but we certainly wish you the best of luck and hope that you'll have hundreds of workers that you can be discussing this health care issue with in the near future.
Well, thank you. That's in the works.
Okay, Eugene. Thanks very much. Eugene, speak with us from Albany, Oregon. We're talking about the cost of health care and its role in recent labor negotiations, and we're going to come back from a break and take more of your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the effect of rising health insurance costs on collective bargaining. If it's been an issue where you work, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, or send us email, TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now to talk about how unions are confronting some of these trends is Edward Fire. He's the president of the IUECWA, the Industrial Division of the Communications Workers of America. Earlier this year, the IUECWA reached an agreement with General Electric. The negotiations, which flared up over health care, were marked by the first walkout of GE in more than 30 years. Edward Fire joins us on the phone from his office here in Washington. It's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you, Mr. Conan. I'm glad to join you.
Do you and other members of your union acknowledge the big financial burden that's placed on American companies by rising health care costs? GE, for example, I think saw its health costs increase about 45% over 3 years.
There's no question. It is a critical problem, but it's not going to be solved, in my judgment, at any bargaining table. There is no corporation in this country that can effectively deal with this whole question of health care cost inflation, even a company as big and powerful and wealthy as General Electric. In my view, this is a national crisis that requires a national solution.
And do you see that it's being addressed in the, as we're coming up to a presidential election year, that this is being focused upon?
Well, I think obviously what happened today, President Bush is, I think, views this Medicare bill as something that he can go to the public with and hopefully to win votes on. I personally think it's a fraud and a sham, but fundamentally they are not dealing, the political system in America, Mr. Cronin, is not dealing with the disgrace the 41 or 42 million people having no health care at all.
In the absence, though, of some sort of a national solution, as you're talking about, and there doesn't seem to be one in the offing, your unions like yours and companies like General Electric have to deal with the situation as it is.
Well, that's the reality of life, and I think in the case of GE, we dealt with it effectively at the bargaining table, if I may sound a little boastful. I don't intend to, but what happened was last January, as you may know, the company exercised a right they had under the collective bargaining agreement to increase certain parts of our health care premiums, and it was kind of like a shot across the bow. They were saying to us, we're going to make you choke down these increases now, and then come the national negotiations for the entire contract in May and June, we're going to try to impose even more health care costs upon the active employees and the retirees. So we drew the line in January, and that paid dividends in the national bargaining because we held the line on health care. But collective bargaining is obviously a wonderful mechanism to provide some form of economic justice at the bargaining table. But health care is so critical. The problems in health care are so profound. Repeating what I said at the beginning, it cannot be effectively dealt with at the bargaining table. The political system must find the will to deal with this issue.
Let's get a caller involved. Maurice joins us on the line from Palo Alto, California.
Yeah, good morning. I think you're latest speaker has very poignantly addressed the problem. My question was, why does the American public, given the loss of jobs we've seen with layoffs, the movement of jobs overseas, and the reduced competitiveness of American companies with foreign companies, continue to insist that health care be married to employment? When are we going to get the picture that this is truly a national crisis, and we have to take health care out of the employment picture so both the employees and the employers can win?
Edward Fire?
That's an excellent point. We used to say that aside from South Africa, the United States of America is the only industrialized country in the world that does not have a national health care system. Well, we can't even say that about South Africa anymore, because now they have a national health care system. It I don't know why. I wish I had the answer, because the caller is exactly right. It just perplexes me that the 41 million people in this country that have no health care are not literally up in arms over that. But somehow, some way, our system, our political system, is such that those that have the clout and those that have the influence, and as witnessed by this recent Medicare, or today's passage of this so-called Medicare bill, insurance companies, doctors, real special interests have the obviously the ear of the president and the ear of the Congress, and they're able to get their way. And why we cannot mobilize people all across this country to demand, you know, health care for all, I simply don't know.
Maurice, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Edward Fire, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. You have a great show, and I love NPR.
Okay. Happy Thanksgiving to
thank you.
Thank you. Edward Fire is president of the IUECWA, the Industrial Division of the Communication Workers of America. He was with us from his office here in Washington. And joining us now to discuss how American corporations are grappling with the rising cost in health care is Kate Sullivan, director of health care policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. She's with us by phone from the offices of the Chamber of Commerce, also here in Washington, and thanks very much.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What are you hearing from your members on this issue? Are they being overwhelmed by rising costs?
They really are, and it's not just the big companies. I mean, the little guys, the small employers that really are what make this country tick. I mean, they are all dealing with these costs, and they find, as others have mentioned, there's very little that corporate America and certainly small business can do about it. It is a challenge. It has to overcome the political obstacles. What we just saw happen today was the Medicare bill. It took 5 years to get to this day. The political wrangling that happened to get to this, this day where it truly was compromised all around. This is just a taste of what it's going to be like when you're talking about transforming a system that affects not 40 million people, but every person in this country.
What do your members say, and again, absent a national resolution of this, which again does not look to be in the offing, what do your members say about the tone of collective bargaining negotiations where this has been an issue so much over the last 3, 4, 5 years?
It's a real challenge. I mean, healthcare is so personal, and those who are negotiating on behalf of the companies, I mean, they understand this, they feel it themselves, with their own experiences going to the doctor and in their own paychecks. What's different, I think, with the collective bargaining is that they have these contracts for several years, and I mean those that are coming up this year after not having been touched for 3 or 4 years, we have had extraordinary cost growth in these past 4 years. For companies, the average cost increase has been 11%, 13.5%, and almost 16% the last 3 years. And that adds up to almost a 50% increase in 3 years at a time of tremendous economic stagnation. It's a real battle. It's a real challenge to go in there because you know that this affects real hardworking families. But there just is no other alternative. There is a bigger picture. I mean, employers are working very hard to not just stem the cost growth, but really reduce costs by trying to find better ways of buying coverage, getting better information about hospitals and doctors, steering people to the hospitals that have the best quality, using the prescription drugs that make the most sense. But it's really, unfortunately, as others have said, this isn't something that can be resolved at the bargaining table. You'll get a temporary reprieve. Things will go on, but we do, as a nation, really need to come to terms with what we want from the healthcare system and what we want from it personally.
Here's a suggestion we got on email from Wendy Tate at Michigan State University. Our contract, she writes, includes loss of pay increases over the next few years, depending on the cost of insurance. If insurance goes up by a certain amount, our pay does not increase. Those kinds of flexible contracts talked about by employers?
That is something we've seen also in some of the union negotiations where they have traded salary increases or taken smaller increases in exchange for holding health care costs down. They knew that the likelihood of health care inflation going up at several times the rate of general inflation was much greater, so it's a good trade-off to make. Generally, employers of all sizes and large companies, they need to look at what are my fixed overhead costs, what am I looking at per worker productivity, what is the environment in which I'm doing business, how can I afford to continue to, you know, ride what we think might be the beginning of a pretty good economic recovery here, but not drown in this cost, this rising cost of healthcare. It has really stalled the economic recovery, I believe, and I think it's going to hurt in terms of adding jobs back, because if every person you hire on, you know, 5 years ago it cost about $3,500, $4,000 per person. Now it's close to $8,000 in health care benefits for every new employee.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Mike, who's with us from Rochester, Minnesota.
Hello, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you know, I work in the healthcare industry. I work at an internationally known medical center in Rochester, Minnesota, and we're even dealing with the cost of health care. As an employee there, you know, it's getting so it's ridiculous that we can't even afford health care within our own system there. And I mean, I understand we're told to do more with less every day at the work and in the institution and the hospital, and yet it's still costing us more for health care benefits. And we're right in the middle of this whole big picture.
Kate Sullivan, I'm not sure you speak for the employer there in Rochester, Minnesota, something the big international clinic, but certainly Mike's situation is one you have to be familiar with.
It really is. And interestingly, hospitals and health systems are often the largest employer in a community, often with unionized workforces themselves. Nobody is immune. In fact, some of the fastest rising costs come within the health sector. I mean, these are people who really know how to use the system. They know the best. They have access to the best technology. But costs, you know, nobody is immune from costs, and certainly healthcare providers have been on the front line to trim their own productivity costs. Some people view them as part of the problem. We view them as trying to be part of the solution. This is something we really need to look at, not only, you know, globally, in a political context, what can we achieve nationally? But it really needs to come down from individuals. What do I want from the system? And we are a nation of very different people, very different beliefs and desires, how we want to interact with our own personal health, with our own money. And we need a system that respects that. I don't think we're a nation that's ready to go to a nationalized healthcare system.
Mike, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Neil.
Kathy Sullivan, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Kate. Yes.
Kate Sullivan is Director of Healthcare Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and she spoke to us from her office here in Washington. And getting back to Paul Ginsberg, here's an email question we got from Brenda in Minneapolis. I keep hearing healthcare costs are increasing so rapidly, I have not heard why. Why have the health costs so suddenly risen? What has changed? And obviously this could be a whole show in and of itself, but if you could give her an answer.
Sure. I'm glad you asked that question. There's really a key short-term and long-term reason. The short-term reason is that we have been retreating from the restrictive managed care that was put into effect in the early and mid-1990s that a lot of people didn't like. They didn't like restricted choice of providers. They didn't like authorization requirements. Workers protested. Employers listened. Managed care was loosened up. We're paying the price now. That's a factor in rising costs. But long term, the key driver of healthcare costs has always been new technology. And this actually is a success story, where technology permits doctors to do more things and patients to get more things addressed in the medical care system. The only problem is it's very expensive.
We're talking about health care and unions. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now to talk about how union jobs became associated with generous benefits packages, including health care, is Harley Shaken. He's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley and specializes in labor and globalization. He joins us on the phone from his office in Berkeley, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
At what point did health care become a basic element of the benefit package of organized workers?
Well, it really grew up in the 1940s and 1950s. At the beginning of the 1940s, there were about 12 million people who were insured through their employer, a little less than 10% of the workforce. But with the rise of industrial unionism during the Second World War and in the immediate aftermath and into the 50s, we saw a real upsurge. So by 1950, it was up to about 50% of the workforce.
How does this compare to Europe, for example, where there's also a strong labor movement?
Well, in Europe, the labor movement and politics in Europe took a fundamentally different path. In Europe, a welfare state was built through the government, and unions were an important actor in building that welfare state. In the U.S., an important dimension of the welfare state was built at the bargaining table. And the tack that U.S. unions took by choice, and often when they had little choice, was to get the benefits that European unions were winning through the government and through political parties to win those at the bargaining table, primarily in the mass production industries.
In the United States, do you think that union workers in particular have come to take these benefits, health care benefits, as fundamental rights?
Oh, I think so. I think union workers do take this as a fundamental right, in part because so much sacrifice went into winning it. There were innumerable strikes. There were real conflicts. Many other things were foregone over the years to win these health care benefits. So for unionized workers, it's both the importance of health care and the fact of all the sacrifice that went into winning it that make it really the crown jewel of all the benefits that unions have won.
So it would be seen as, whittling away at that to give up any concessions.
Whittling away, to say the least. It would be, I think, considered even more than whittling away. It would be considered unraveling the very fabric of what unions have won over the years.
Harley Shaken, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Harley Shaken, professor at the University of California at Berkeley, who specializes in labor and globalization. And before we leave this, Paul Ginsberg, as we look ahead, what do you see?
Well, you know, one thing I get from all the comments you've had today is the fact that a lot of the focus is on who pays for rising health care costs, but no one is focusing on what does the country need to do. Some people said that leaders need to focus.
Mm-hmm.
And I've really been struck about how the little interest there seems to be among leaders in industry, in labor, in governments, to really confront the issue. And I think what the issue is that the American healthcare system is capable of providing a lot more healthcare than many people in the nation are able to afford. And that inevitably, we're going to have to get to the point where people cannot have all of the health care that they would like. We'd like them to get all the important health care that they need, but not necessarily all they would like, and very few people are willing to say that.
Rationing is a concept hidden in there somewhere.
Yeah? Absolutely.
Paul Ginsberg, thank you very much for being with us today.
Been a pleasure.
Paul Ginsberg here with us in Studio 3A. He's president of the Center for Studying Health System Change. And when we come back from a break, we're going to be talking about some of those good economic numbers we heard reference to earlier in the program. Is the economy picking up where you live? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.